This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello and welcome to the Today in Parliament podcast for Friday the 13th of October. In this edition, Mr. Speaker tells MPs it's time for them to seize control of the Commons agenda.
The idea that a cabal of whips, a kind of secret squirrel society, should be able to block such a reform does seem to me to be quite wrong.
Does the government's Brexit bill give ministers too much ability to rewrite the law?
The bill confers on ministers wider Henry VIII powers than we have ever seen.
And can any government stem the flow of fake news on social media?
Do you think it is realistic for us to think we could start to regulate or legislate for standards to be applied online in this field?
I think it's an unbelievably scary world if we don't try.
But first tonight, they seek it here, they seek it there. So where, oh where, is the European withdrawal bill? Most Westminster observers expected the Commons to embark on 8 days of detailed debate in Committee of the Whole House pretty much as soon as their conference recess was over. Eyebrows were raised when it wasn't on this week's agenda, and they shot skywards when it wasn't put on the agenda for next week. At Commons Business Questions yesterday, the SNP's shadow leader of the House, Pete Wishart, was puzzled.
When are we going to see the repeal bill? We sort of thought you might have mentioned a little bit about that today. Because as the Leader of the House knows, this bill is still unacceptable to the Scottish Government and it's not prepared to give this bill a legislative consent motion. We are not prepared to have our devolution settlement undermined, our Parliament emasculated and subjected to this unprecedented power grab.
The Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, cancelled patience.
What I can say to all members is, of course, there are some 300 amendments and 54 new clauses being proposed, quite rightly by members who have very real concerns about the bill, and those are being closely evaluated. That is taking a bit of time to have proper, thoughtful, well-considered responses to those, but we will, of course, be bringing forward the Committee of the Whole House just as soon as we're able to.
There is little doubt that some of those amendments to this crucial Brexit bill pose a real threat to the government's tenuous Commons majority. The threat in chief is posed by amendments from the Conservative former Attorney General, Dominic Grieve, who wants to limit the sweeping powers that ministers propose to take in the bill so they can rewrite 4 decades of accumulated EU law for the process of enacting Brexit.
If the government says we don't intend to try to use this to carry out, you know, dark and dangerous changes to the laws of the United Kingdom, I think on the whole I'm prepared to give certainly a Conservative government the benefit of the doubt. I think I'd probably even give a Labour government the benefit of the doubt. But that's not a reason why Parliament should just roll over and say, oh, this is all fine, you do whatever you like. We are supposed to be the guardians of the Constitution. I think that's why we're given a portcullis as our emblem.
He was giving evidence to the Commons Procedure Committee, where a Conservative colleague, Rahul Jayawardena, wondered if his fears about so-called Henry VIII powers were a bit over-egged.
My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the government proposes restraints on delegated powers so that it can't be used for certain things, such as, of course, taxation, making retrospective provision, creating criminal offences, and indeed implementing the withdrawal agreement. So would you not recognise that many systems are in place already to ensure that the government brings forward legislation so that it is discussed by all members when it needs to be, and that those matters get the scrutiny that our voters deserve?
I'm afraid that 20 years in this place have convinced me that we could improve the processes and procedures of this House enormously if we had the will to do it without messing the government up or preventing it getting its legislation, and that we don't do it. So this isn't an isolated... It is isolated because it is the most extraordinary example of arrogation of power to the state that I've seen in my 20 years in the House. I don't suppose there's ever been anything quite like this in peacetime, ever. So for that reason, I think we should be very cautious.
With the Prime Minister's bag carrier, Seema Kennedy, watching intently from the public seats, Mr. Grieve insisted his motivation was not to somehow derail the process of leaving the EU. His concern was that Parliament should agree what promised to be important legal changes.
What I think is important is that we ensure that if, as a consequence of this legislation, there are going to be significant changes to primary legislation which is of importance, that this takes place with proper debate. And that must mean probably on the floor of the House. I think that's the absolute bottom line on this.
A warning shot about the extent of those Henry VIII powers the government proposes to take was fired over the conference recess, when a normally rather staid Lords Committee, the Delegated Powers Committee, said they gave extraordinary powers to rewrite the law with only limited oversight by Parliament, by what are called statutory instruments. The former Clerk of the Commons, Sir Robert Rogers, now Lord Lisvane, was a member of that committee.
The scope of the powers that are being given to ministers, or which ministers wish to take for themselves, is huge. And it's not only the Delegated Powers Committee in the Lords, but the Constitution Committee has said the bill weaves a tapestry of delegated powers that are breathtaking in terms of both their scope and potency. And we said that the bill confers on ministers wider Henry VIII powers than we have ever seen.
But surely, even then, these powers are, to some extent, subject to the oversight of Parliament, and MPs could, if they wanted to, as it were, call in some of these measures and say, no, you can't do that.
In strict theory, yes, but not in terms of practical parliamentary politics.
One issue here is that the bill would allow ministers to exercise their powers through a procedure that would be very hard for backbench MPs to block.
On that, I have to say the Delegated Powers Committee was pretty firm that is really unacceptable.
Now, in theory, MPs can block statutory instruments by a process called praying against them. But the Labour MP Helen Goodman, who's also a member of the Procedure Committee, said recent events on student tuition fees, where the election got in the way, suggested that was a flimsy safeguard.
On tuition fees, we prayed against the statutory instrument. The government refused to give us an opportunity to debate it or to vote on it, and they just pushed it through. They will, if the bill goes through as it is now, they're going to have that opportunity on every piece of law that is translated from the European Union to our statute book. And the whole referendum campaign was run on a slogan of take back control, but the control was meant to be taken back by Parliament, not by the executive.
One interesting player in all this is the Conservative former Constitution Minister John Penrose. He was pro-Remain at the referendum, but now accepts the referendum verdict. Even so, he's backing Dominic Grieve's amendments.
There are some people who want to use different amendments to try and derail the entire Brexit process by stealth, and I'm not having any of that. But I think that what we can do is to fix one of the flaws that some of those opponents are gesturing at, but we can do it in a way which makes the bill work and makes it safer. And for anybody who's a Democrat, that's got to be a good answer, providing we don't derail Brexit in the process.
And he says ministers are engaging.
I think they're definitely in listening mode, partly because any sensible government in a hung parliament has to be in listening mode more than usual in any case. But partly because I think, genuinely, I think we can take them at their word when they say they aren't trying to sort of, make this into a power grab. They're very open to the notion that if you can find a better way of doing it which solves people's concerns about power grabs and all this sort of stuff, that isn't what they want to do. So they're very happy to listen to ways to sort of take that trick.
Labour's Helen Goodman, though, is guarded about the prospect of a solution.
Well, I hope that, as a member of the Procedure Committee, that we're going to be able to produce a powerful report that says how this ought to be done with some much stronger mechanisms. What I would like to see is the capacity to amend, the capacity to debate, independent decision-making process as to which mechanism we use for this secondary legislation. If we get all that, I think that would be a suitable compromise. A weaker report from the committee, I think, would still leave the Labour front bench whipping against what the government is proposing to do.
Helen Goodman. Are inaccurate polls and fake news swinging elections and referendums in Britain? Is our democracy now wide open to manipulation because cyberspace isn't properly policed? And are the voters being misled by inaccurate polls that fail to detect what's really happening on the ground, as in the last two elections? Well, a special House of Lords Select Committee has been investigating, with a Labour peer, Lord Lipsey, in the chair.
So the second election running, the polls got it wrong. You can argue about how wrong, but they got it pretty wrong. And this is no mean thing in a democracy, because it's perfectly possible that what people read of what the polls are saying affects the way they vote. So I think it's quite right that a parliamentary inquiry should try to get to the bottom of this.
The peers heard from pollsters and political scientists. Carl Miller from the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos told them that the more startling a poll's findings were, the bigger the headlines it produced. The Scottish independence referendum saw a classic example.
The effect of a poll is obviously proportionate to the amount of coverage it receives, either in conventional or social media. Well, the amount of coverage a poll receives is proportionate itself, or reflects how sensational the outcome the poll is. Let's dwell for a second on the single poll on the front page of Sunday Times a week out of the Scottish referendum, putting the yes vote ahead. There were so many other polls done over that time that gave no a comfortable lead still, yet that was the poll that everybody saw.
Nick Moon of Moonlight Research told them one problem was that snapshots of public opinion at one moment during an election were being treated as predictions of the final result.
A poll 2 weeks before the election is not a forecast. The pollsters wouldn't say it's a forecast. Journalists will try and make it into a forecast. But you cannot treat a poll 2 weeks before an election as a forecast. You can't not treat a poll a day before the election as a forecast.
Oh, yes, you can. If you allow for late swings and differential turnouts and all sorts of other factors, the poll that was taken in 1970, just before the election, was absolutely... all the polls were completely wrong because they didn't account for the late swing in that election.
But realistically, there's not very much late swing on the last even in an election. We've never seen an election like this last one. And the other history of all the elections I've polled in is the campaign makes no difference at all. Whatever happens in the campaign makes absolutely no difference. The polls are there at the beginning and they're there at the end. What was extraordinary about this election was we saw a change during the election that we've never seen before.
The Labour peer Lord Foulkes intervening there. So could any distorting effect from polls be prevented by banning them in the later stages of an election? That question was put to Professor Susan Banducci of Exeter University by the Conservative Lord Smith of Hindhead.
If the polling is inaccurate, then obviously that's a serious concern.
Yeah.
And it might answer the question as to why so many other countries ban pre-election polling. 16 in the EU, Canada as well. Would you think that's a sensible idea, why they do that abroad?
No. Briefly, I'm not convinced that those sorts of benefits, and again, they would be not clearly evidenced benefits of banning polling, outweigh the benefits of that information, plus the idea that we are an open society and free, and there's freedom of expression, and that is part of the important bit of information that we get in a campaign.
The committee also heard that the social media space was running wild and people didn't know who was feeding them information. Professor Chris Hanretty of Royal Holloway, University of London.
It's a bit like the New Yorker cartoon of long, long ago. On the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Now, no one knows whether you're a bot or not. No one knows whether you've been working from 9 to 5 in Moscow pumping out disinformation.
The crossbench or independent peer, Baroness O'Neill, wondered if single countries could exert any control.
Do you think it is realistic for us to think we could start to regulate or legislate for standards to be applied online in this field?
I think it's an unbelievably scary world if we don't try. I think the rise of online debate genuinely challenges some basic conceptions around the nation state, around the way we've collected legal authority around territorial units. Of course, the transjurisdictionality of all of this is a massive headache for any national legislator or law enforcement agency. But I think we need to try.
Carl Miller of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media answering there. He added that other countries were exploiting the lack of regulation.
The information space is considered by foreign militaries to be literally a theatre of war. We know that there are attempts to use influence operations, media operations and so on. And in this space, it feels like we are not reacting to all the different ways in which people can be lied to and can be manipulated using these new online worlds.
The committee is some way from taking a view on issues like banning opinion polls close to polling day, but Lord Lipsey's not ruling anything out.
What is certainly true is that nothing is off the table if the majority of a committee, conclude that strong measures are required, strong measures are what we will recommend. If we conclude that everything's perfect, well, that's what we're saying.
David Lipsey. Now, should MPs control what they debate and when they debate it? At the moment, the Commons agenda is mostly set by the government, and backbench MPs have no direct say over, for example, how long they get to discuss detailed amendments to government legislation. 8 years ago, in the wake of the MP's expenses scandal, the Wright Committee, led by the then Labour MP Tony Wright, suggested creating a House Business Committee so as to improve MPs' image. It would take control of their agenda away from the so-called usual channels of behind-the-scenes talks between the party whips. The 2010 Con-Lib coalition pledged to bring that in, but then quietly dropped the promise. Now, though, no lesser figure than Mr. Speaker Burko has used a lecture to the parliamentary think tank the Hansard Society to call for MPs to at least be given the chance to debate whether they should have that fabled House Business Committee. He told me why.
At the moment, the House Business Committee is, if you will, missing in action. And this is a wholly unsatisfactory state of affairs. This is an issue that must be resolved out of respect for the House. And the sooner the idea is put to the House, so much the better.
The thought is that this committee might do things like say, hang on a minute, government, we need more days to consider MPs' detailed amendments to some bill or other. We need a longer report stage. And the sort of fraternity of whips historically has always hated the idea of things like that happening and interfering with their planning of the working of the Commons. It's inconceivable, isn't it, that they wouldn't be A, against this, and B, wouldn't be able to stop it.
I don't think it's inconceivable. I think that that is an unworthy pessimism and negativity, Mark, on your part. I would just point out to you that many of the recommendations of the Wright Committee were objected to by government and opposition whips in the 2005-10 Parliament. I remember pressing very hard for a debate and votes on the Wright Committee recommendations to be held before the end of that Parliament. And I was successful in that, and I did so because I felt there was a real appetite for the Wright Committee reforms. And members of Parliament, in very large numbers, voted for the report and the reforms. There was, if you like, almost a peasant's revolt. So just as there was support for the Backbench Business Committee and for various other of the reforms, the election of select committee chairs by secret ballot of the whole House, I believe that there could well be very substantial support in the House on both sides, and perhaps particularly amongst newer members, for such a reform. Whether I'm right or not, I don't know, but the idea that a cabal of whips, a kind of secret squirrel society, should be able to block such a reform does seem to me to be quite wrong. I'm in favour of transparency, and with the best will in the world, it would be very hard to characterise as transparent the underworld that are the government and opposition whips offices. Let's hear the view of members of Parliament as a whole. And as Speaker, my responsibility is not to speak up for the government or to speak up for the opposition, but to speak up for the rights of the House.
So you'd be using your good offices as Speaker to try and get this to the wicket?
I would certainly like to get it to the wicket. I know of Conservative backbenchers and Labour backbenchers and backbenchers from some of the smaller parties who would love to have such a change. I would also point out that there are models for a House Business Committee, even if it isn't called that, in other parts of the UK. For example, there is the Scottish Parliamentary Bureau, which in the Scottish Parliament determines the allocation of time for business. Of course, government will tend to have a big and loud voice, and often that voice will prove to be decisive. But there are other players, and they should have a right to say what they think. I very much defend the right of the government to have its business scheduled. Otherwise, the result of elections would effectively be neutered or voided, and that would be quite wrong. But the idea that it should be exclusively for the government to decide what is debated, when, and for how long would, I think, offend against the democratic instinct.
In order for this to fly, it probably needs to get debated relatively soon, at least before Christmas. I can imagine a situation where, oh yes, certainly we'll have a debate when we can find the time, and then the time is never found.
There is that danger. Mark, I know of no significant body of backbench members saying, please keep the process of deciding what is debated when and for how long as secretive as possible. Please restrict to an absolute minimum the number of people who have a say in the matter, and please ensure that I don't get a chance to express a view. There is no way that colleagues would object to having a debate on this. I think probably the challenge is to garner support amongst perhaps a number of members on both sides of the House who would favour the creation of a House Business Committee. Now, if such people were to come forward and to say, for example, to the Backbench Business Committee, let's have a debate on this matter, that in itself would be some progress.
The Speaker, John Bercow. And you can see his Hansard Society lecture over on BBC Parliament tomorrow night at 11. Finally tonight, MPs have been debating the very real healing power of art. The all-party group on health and the arts has put out a report on how drama and art can help people with all kinds of medical conditions. And this week, the former Arts Minister, Ed Vaizey, led a debate in Westminster Hall, highlighting the possibilities.
In Stockport, an arts on prescription pilot which offered visual art and music projects to women who had or were at risk of postnatal depression showed that every woman who participated experienced improvements in their general health, and all but one a reduction in their level of depression.
The Labour MP Gloria De Piero related the story of a woman in her constituency who
suffered from depression and anxiety, who tells me, "I'm not yet recovered from my illness, but I am now strong enough to go to this amazing place every day." The amazing place is called the Huthwaite Hub. It relies in large part on lottery funding. Does he agree with me that former coalfield communities do not get their fair share of funding from the lottery, which would enable more projects like this to help many more people?
But was this more than a rally, just lining up MPs to cheer a cause? After the debate, I asked Ed Vaizey what he'd wanted to achieve.
I called the debate really to challenge the government to take this agenda seriously, this agenda being the need to understand and support the role that the arts can play in our health and well-being. And as I said in the debate, everything from mothers who might suffer from postnatal depression through to our elderly population can benefit from arts interventions. The challenge is whether the government takes it forward and whether they're prepared to put any money behind it. On the first point, is the government serious? The Culture White Paper stated very clearly that the government would take on board the recommendations of the all-party group on health and the arts, which was the report that was published in July that this debate was structured around. And I'm pleased to say that the Arts Minister, John Glenn, did turn up with a copy of the report, heavily annotated with post-it notes. And I think he is going to take it seriously. What he needs to do, I think, is to engage other ministers. It's all very well for the Arts Minister to say it's a good thing, but if a minister in the Department of Health or a minister in local government isn't taking it seriously, then the agenda won't get very far. And one of the things I said to the Arts Minister in the debate, without wishing to appear rude, was that in some ways I would much rather have had a Health Minister respond. It's an issue of some sadness to me that the last Health Minister to make a speech about the arts was Alan Johnson, and yet we have a Health Minister in Jeremy Hunt who was the Arts Minister for several years. So it would be great to see the Health Minister take this seriously. On the issue of money, we specifically, as the all-party group, haven't said that this is something that needs money. And when I was the Arts Minister discussing with the Department of Health whether there was any money, I was told firmly there was no money. Part of it is about a climate change where local authorities and indeed health authorities should at least be thinking, can we engage with arts organisations in an effective way to help our health prevention programmes and to help intervention programmes with people who are isolated or depressed or lonely or simply need stimulation because of their condition. But it would be good if there was a small sum of money that helped promote this agenda.
What happens next? What are the next moves?
Well, the great thing about the debate was that many MPs did come to the debate. It was late on a Wednesday after voting in the main chamber had finished, so the fact they were all there showed a real commitment, and a lot of MPs were there to cite specific examples in their constituency. So we've now got a core of about a dozen or 15 MPs who are very interested in this agenda. It does mean that we can use the platform of the all-party group to invite this health minister that I'm desperate to talk to, as well as ministers from other departments, to come and tell us whether this is on their agenda, and if so, what are they going to do about it?
Ed Vaizey. And that's all from us for this week. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor is Peter Knowles. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast for Friday, the 13th of October. Thanks for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.com. radio4.co.uk/radio4.